Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a discussion about good writing and the words that put actions in scenes, shows eccentricity in characters, and conveys drama in plots. Verbs. Now, quickly, before you change stations, Constance Hale is my guest today. She's the author of Wired Style and Sin and Syntax. Her latest book is an entertaining and informative book on how to write better. In fact, I'll wager it's the most entertaining book you'll ever read that actually contains sentence diagrams. Vex, hex, smash, smooch. Let verbs power your writing. Explains the grammatical rules and concepts that vex us. Decries the stupid rules of grammar that hex us. Smash the common writing errors we make from time to time. And smooch the gift of truly inventive prose, using examples from some of our finest writers. Constance Hale has taught at the Nyman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University and University of California, Berkeley. And she joins us today by phone to talk about her new book. Constance Hale, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for having me.
This book, Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh, looking at the power of verbs, what made you decide to write about this subject? You give numerous examples of how nouns are tending to smother verbs today in a lot of our writing.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I love nouns too, but I just learned, having written, I wrote a book called Sin and Syntax about 12 years ago, and I've talked a lot about the book. I teach writing, and I use the book in teaching writing, and I found that I just had more and more and more to say about verbs, mostly because I really think that verbs have everything to do with us writing better. And I had a lot of questions from people about verb tenses, about the active voice and the passive voice, about the subjunctive, dangling participles. There was so much more to say about verbs that I decided to spend some time doing a little more research, finding out more myself, and put it all into one book.
One of the things the book deals with is how many written and unwritten rules there are about writing that tend to constrain us in our writing a lot of times. And when we read the best examples, you see those rules broken time and time again.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. This is actually one of the questions that motivated me to write the book and informed a lot of my research. I had been a good student probably when I was in high school, but then when I wrote Sin and Syntax, I did a lot of research and read all the writing manuals I could put my hands on. And I kept finding certain rules that just didn't seem right to me. They didn't comport with what I knew about English as a writer and as an editor. And so in this book, I actually went back and did more research on how and why these rules got created. And it turns out that English didn't used to have a grammar. It was our English grammar that is taught in schools was kind of invented in the 1700s by some priests and clerks that decided if Latin had a grammar, English should have one too. And they took the rules from Latin and tried to impose them on English. So a lot of the rules that were taught by perfectly well-meaning teachers are actually wrong, or they don't actually describe the way English works. A perfect example is the split infinitive, the idea that you're not supposed to put an adjective between the to and the verb when you use an infinitive. So those grammar teachers would say, to boldly go, which is the slogan of Star Trek, is
right.
Wrong. Well, what's wrong with that? It's perfectly clear. You understand it.
Yes.
I understand it. So that, unfortunately, a lot of those rules that have been handed down ever since the 1700s are just, they are, number one, maybe not right. Number two, lead to a writing that is kind of stiff and formal. And number three, don't necessarily help us write better. So the focus of this book is, I mean, I try to sort of navigate those confusing waters and say, here's what you need to know. Here's what you can forget.
Speaking of those rules, one that comes up early in the book is, I guess this comes from Strunk and White, use Anglo-Saxon words. They're
Isn't
always
that
better.
Amazing? Yeah. And this is something, again, Rich, this is something that I had heard. I have tons of friends who are writers and who teach writing, and they repeat this over and over again. And I've always kind of scratched my head about that. I grew up in Hawaii. Let's just say that we didn't even have a consciousness of Anglo-Saxon in Hawaii. We were using Japanese words and Chinese words and throwing all kinds of lively words into our language. And so I guess I was primed to be suspicious of something like this. And yet, again, when I went back and read writing books, there it is. In Fowler, which was published in 1926, prefer the Anglo-Saxon to the Romance. In George Orwell's famous essay, Politics and the English Language, prefer Anglo-Saxon words, Strunk and White, Bill Zinsser. I kept thinking, why is this? So I went and I did a whole bunch of research. You know, I've tried to spare my readers. I spent a lot of time in the library so my readers don't have to. It turns out we have about, well, no one agrees, but we have somewhere between 450,000 and 650,000 words in English today. We have an amazingly rich language that has sucked up words from other languages ever since the very beginning, way back with the Celts and the Romans and in the British Isles. And as a consequence, we have lots of synonyms. We have, as writers, we have so many ways to affect our changes in our sentences in all kinds of interesting ways. Well, that's because we have a lot of synonyms. Where do we get those synonyms? From a lot of languages. It turns out there are only 4,500 words in the English language that come from Anglo-Saxon. So, to me, that is a ridiculous rule.
Well, that's a terrible minority. That's a minority of the tyranny. Tyranny of the minority.
Why would we want to restrict? And just to show you how ridiculous this idea is, you know, prefer the Anglo-Saxon word. Anglo-Saxon words are better because they're short and they're crisp and they have good hard consonants. Well, let's take two really common words in English, dog and cat. One of those words is Anglo-Saxon in origin, and one of those words is Latin in origin. Do you know which is which? Does it matter which is which? It turns out cat comes from Latin, dog comes from Anglo-Saxon. I don't think no one can make an argument that cat is somehow a less good word than dog. But so anyway, that's a big red herring that I try to take on in the book.
To smash, in other words. And the book, Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smoosh, goes through each chapter. And explain the idea of Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smoosh.
Well, okay, there's actually two ideas to it. The first one was just the title. I wanted to have a title that was all verbs. I wanted to almost have this kind of comic hero, pow, crash, bam, boom title, and Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch did that for me. But it also told the story of English. If you look at those four words, actually none of them is Anglo-Saxon. Vex comes to us from Old French. Hex comes to us from Pennsylvania Dutch. Smash is a bit of a mystery. It's just kind of appeared on the scene in 1850 when someone probably took the word mash and took the word smack and smashed them together. And it's a great little piece of onomatopoeia. And smooch is a bit of a mystery, too. There was a word similar to it in one English dialect from the 1500s. There's a similar word in German. But again, it's this kind of slangy, fun word.
It's an onomatopoeia to us, wouldn't it?
And it has onomatopoeia. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So partly the title was intended to just tell the story of English, that we have all these great verbs that have come to us in a lot of different ways, and it's so much fun to use them. But then I also used those four words as kind of the organizing principle of my chapters. So in each chapter, there's a section called Vex, and that is where I take on the kind of vexing idea. Maybe it's the history of English, or maybe it's verb tenses, all of them, all 12 of them. Or maybe it's phrasal verbs, these weird verbs that have a verb and then a little preposition after it that changes the meaning of the verb. So Vex tries, in the Vex section of the chapter, I try as clearly as possible to explain this little particular corner of English to my readers. In Hex, Hex, of course, means to curse or to put a pox on. In the Hex section, I take on these myths and try to banish them altogether. Smash is where I get to play around with some examples of bad writing, and whether it be Joe Biden or Sarah Palin or bad headlines, the smash section is where I say, here's someone who did not know the rules at all, just made a mess of English, and we have a little bit of fun with those examples. And then in the smooch section, at the end of the chapter, I try to show writing written by a writer who really understands this particular aspect of English and uses this aspect to make meaning in his or her sentences. They may be following the rules, they may be breaking the rules. And, you know, I'm one of those people who believes you can't really, in order to break the rules, you need to know them. And I think you see that in really wonderful writing. Wonderful writers know how to break the rules or to bend them, but they know how to do it because they really understand the way the sentence ticks.
I was struck by one example by Carson McCullers in which she uses tenses, and it's present tense, talking about a little town and how
in Georgia.
Yeah, and how it was dying, and then goes to immediately to the past tense to describe the town when it was thriving more.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beautiful writing. And you read these things unconsciously. You know, of
exactly.
course, that's the best part about good writing is you don't notice all these devices. It's just good writing.
Yeah, and the one thing that's interesting to me is when you talk to the writers, they, of course, know what they're doing. But they do it in such an artful way that the reader's affected by the writing but may not notice what exactly it is that's creating that effect. In the Carson McCullers, it's the opening few paragraphs of The Ballad of a Sad Cafe, which is a wonderful novella. And what it shows is, first of all, her language is very simple, but it's beautiful. And she sticks to the present tense and then very, very clearly shifts into the past to do a flashback. And that's just an example of, as a writer, you need to sort of understand what those two tenses are, know when to use the present tense, know when to use the past, and most importantly, know that you can shift back and forth between tenses, but you have to do it very intentionally, and you can't just do it willy-nilly in every sentence.
Yeah. My guest today is a journalist, writer, and teacher, Constance Hale. Her new book is titled Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing. What a great title. And throughout it, it's very readable. Even though there are sentence diagrams in the book, it is incredibly readable for a book with sentence diagrams. I have to say that. But, you know, the smash and the hex part are some of the funnest to read about. Earlier in our conversation, we talked about nouns tending to smother verbs, and there's a whole little section on legal writing and how we've tend to turn nouns into other words to basically obfuscate meaning. I think there's a business who wrote of closing a factory. This is part of our Global Improvement Product Enhancement Program. And this, the whole legal writing of obfuscating meaning, that is really starts out in the business world, legal writing. It's infiltrated everything. It's infiltrated journalism where you use a 50-cent word where you could use a 10-cent word to mm-hmm. really give us the meaning.
Mm-hmm. And it's complicated. I'm trying to say a bunch of different things in the book, but if I were to organize them in a simple way, I'd say the first thing we need to do as writers, if what we want to do is be clear and understood as opposed to being purposely obfuscating. But, you know, we have such a choice, whether it's nouns or verbs, we have such a choice in English. And so I really encourage writers to take time with each noun and verb to try to get the most precise, the most visual, the simplest, but not simplicity at the expense of beauty. I mean, I think sometimes we can go too far in trying to be simple because what we also want to do is be meaningful and have our sentences be beautiful. So, you know, the point is to pick your words very carefully, make them precise, make them visual, make them maybe pay attention to the way they sound. And that should be priority number one. Obviously, some politicians, some business people, some lawyers, some bureaucrats go in the direction of really abstract language, which is partly what we're talking about, these kind of abstract nouns that don't have a lot of meaning. Enhancement, you know, you were quoting Global Improvement Enhancement Program. You know, enhancement is kind of an abstract word, and so what people do when either they don't know how to use English correctly or when they're purposely trying to blur lines is they go to these abstract dictionary words that maybe they don't even know what they mean and the readers may not know what they mean. And what I'm trying to do is get people to kind of just think differently about word choice.
You mentioned headlines earlier, and I was reading, I really hadn't thought about this, but you know, the art of headline writing has changed with the internet because, and you write about this, all these wonderful headlines that used to take place are a lot of times watered down for search engine optimization.
Mm-hmm.
Has that really affected journalism that much?
Well, it's one of many things that have affected journalism. But, you know, I was there was a time for a couple of years when I was a newspaper copy editor, and I always used to say I did pretty well in English as a teenager, and I also happened to do really well in math. My dad's a mathematician. I thought, wow, I found the only profession that combines haiku and algebra. Because writing a headline in the old days, you had to have this, it was kind of mathematical. You'd have to fit a certain number of characters on each line, and you'd be told how big the letters had to be, and you had to find a way of making a little bit of poetry in these very mathematical calculations. And it was a real art, and the art of few words. It was like haiku. And now, unfortunately, with websites, a couple of things have happened. One is headlines. You don't have those tight spaces necessarily, or the three-line headlines the way that newspapers did. So sometimes there isn't such a premium on poetry or haiku. But the other problem is, as you say, the way people use Google is generally to use keywords, and keywords tend to be the most general common nouns that are out there. And so if a website wants to attract hits, a lot of times it will go for those general common nouns as taglines or maybe headlines or even words in the copy, which means I don't want to say a dumbing down of language, because there are a lot of websites that are doing wonderful work out there, and there's some great writers who are publishing online. And, of course, even the New York Times, a lot of people read it online. So you're still getting great writing online, but it is interesting the way Google and search influences writing, and it influences it in such a way as to dumb it down a little bit.
One of the interesting things I found about the book is very easy, helpful hints about how to make your writing a little more crisp. And it goes from very simple things like there, using the word there, T-H-E-R-E. You write, it's a false start and a bad idea, and show very simply how you can write that and then edit yourself to make the start a much better start.
And, you know, it's perfectly natural. So many of us, I'm sure I've done it in my conversation with you, Rich, we start a sentence with there is or there are. It's a very, very natural habit, and there's nothing wrong with the habit itself. It's the way we communicate. But when you write, what you have to do is go back and find those sentences. So if I were to say, there are many reasons for you and I to be talking today, or for you and me to be talking today, I've got to get my grammar right. There are many reasons for you and me to be talking today. I can just recast that sentence to say, you and I are talking today for many reasons. And the sentence all of a sudden is just much more direct. It's much more simple. We get right to the point more quickly. So, yeah, I have a lot of little tips sprinkled in every chapter. Some of them small things like that. Some of them are actual ideas for writing. Like, you know, say you want a little writing exercise. Why don't you go and I might use a piece of writing as an example and then give you a hint about how you might go do the same thing yourself and just practice some of your new verb muscles.
Let's talk about one of those exercises. I thought it was a great exercise. It was a piece of writing from the New Yorker. Garrison Keillor was watching people hop over a puddle on a curb, and the verb usage was wonderful. He's, you know, making these assessments, I could watch short, fat people hopping over this puddle all day long. Tall, lanky people, they just elongate their steps. I just kept hoping they would go up in the air. It's a wonderful, wonderful essay. But you had an exercise based on Keillor's essay, and it's about observing a whole group of people doing the same thing and come up with different ways to describe, say, people getting on a bus and putting a fare in, something like that.
Right. It's such a great, you know, good writing. Sometimes people think good writing is just talent. You know, like some people are just geniuses and they just knock off these sentences and they come out perfectly. Other people are a little wiser and they say, well, no, it takes hard work too. Genius is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. But actually, I think something that people don't realize is how much part of good writing is close observation, careful observation. So a lot of writing happens before you even put the pen to paper or put your fingers on the keyboard. It's how closely are you observing people? What kinds of details are you noting? And in this particular exercise based on that essay, Hoppers, by Garrison Keillor, the amazing thing is he just goes and stands on a street corner and watches a whole bunch of people do the most common thing, basically just walk to work. And they hit a puddle and they have to hop over it. And he finds a different way. He observes so closely how each person jumps a little bit differently or maybe stops and studies the puddle before lurching across. And in those verbs, he's doing two things. One is he's just trying to find a more precise verb that describes more visually and more precisely how that person is doing something. But he's also trying to capture character in the verb, just in the verb, in the way you describe someone doing something very simple. You can get at the whole psychology of the person. And so that's the exercise that follows that. Go watch a whole bunch of people do the same thing, a completely banal, the kind of banal thing that most of us would ignore, and that's the difference between a writer and a non-writer, is that the writers pay attention to the smallest details.
You know, this gets into another, you're talking about Keeler finding the exact precise verb to describe this. A lot of times writers will use that precision to the detriment of understanding when, you know, writing a verb that is more precise and less instructive. I think you refer to them as tuxedo verbs at one point. It's a verb that is grander than it needs to be to communicate the meaning you're trying to get out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think this is also partly, it comes out of the way we're taught writing, because often I think in high school we're encouraged to use big words to stretch a little bit, and we're encouraged to write long, and so we develop some bad habits. I don't think it's wrong for teachers to encourage students to try to stretch their vocabulary, but what you always have to remember when you're writing is that you have an audience. So it's not just a matter of going and picking the fanciest verb you can, but actually the verb that conveys the meaning that you want to convey, and it conveys it to a reader. So I think that sense of an audience out there who's going to read your work is very important. And, you know, when we're writing English papers, the only person we really have to impress is the teacher. When you're writing a piece of journalism, or you're writing a memoir, or even if you're writing a letter to someone you love, you need to have that person, that audience, in your head all the time, and be choosing words not just to hit the nail on the head for yourself, but also will hit the nail on the head for that reader. So there's this interesting exchange between two people that happens, between two people or many people, that happens in any wonderful piece of writing.
My guest today is writer and journalist Constance Hale. Her new book is titled Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh, Let Verbs Power Your Writing, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about some of those bugaboo verbs, and in some cases nouns. There's a great little section on what you refer to as the Simonizing Nouns and Verbs, the idea of putting I-Z-E onto nouns and sometimes verbs to make them a little more important than they should be or are.
Yeah, it's an interesting habit. It's a relatively recent habit, you know, especially in the last century. Again, it's for some reason it makes people think that the verb is fancier or better or something, but it almost never makes the verb better. I mean, a really great example is utilize, which people use a lot, and most of the time we just need the verb use. It's better, it's shorter, it means the same thing. Simonize was kind of fun. It was a joke.
Yeah,
when,
right. I know. Yeah.
You know, as a way to shine up your car, that word has actually sort of disappeared from the vocabulary, mm-hmm. thankfully. But there are just a lot of habits like this that people do to sort of punch things up or make them appear fancier when they really don't need to be.
I like there's this whole section titled headache verbs, and I'll just mm-hmm. talk about some of the words that you picked out. For example, cleave. This is an unusual word because it can mean to tear apart and also to stick together.
Stick together, yeah. It's amazing. Contronyms, they're called. These words in English that have two meanings that are absolutely opposite of each other and contradict each other. Some of the other headache verbs, the ones that I probably care about the most, there are some words like decimate is an interesting word, where it actually originally came from this practice in the Roman army of killing one-tenth of the troops after an unsuccessful battle. Wow. That's where the DECI comes from, and it means decimate means to reduce by one-tenth. Most people don't know that. They don't know their Latin. They don't look carefully at the word and realize that's the meaning of the word, and they use it as a synonym for annihilate. I actually think it's great to have both of those words. It's great to have the word annihilate, which means to wipe out everything, and it's great to have the word decimate, which means to wipe out less than everything. And so I'm a real champion for preserving the true meaning of words so that we preserve our rich vocabulary. This also happens with verb pairs. My favorite one to talk about is aggravate and irritate.
Yes.
Irritate, we all know what irritate means. It means to annoy, to vex, to trouble. And aggravate means to make that condition worse. So So aggravate means to take that irritation goes and becomes worse. I think it's great to have these two separate verbs, which mean then there's a shade of a difference between them, because I believe in nuance and I believe in precision. More and more people are using the word aggravate to mean irritate, and you see it in the best newspapers in the country. Although I have to say, sometimes when the grammar cops catch them, the newspapers go and change the word back to irritate. But again, I can understand why people confuse the words, and I know that some linguists say, well, this is the way this word is being used, so now we just need to accept it. But I'm not usually conservative, but I am conservative when it comes to preserving distinctions between words, because I think it gives us a richer language. And there are so many more. Oh, gosh, there's affect and effect, which people confuse all the time. And so I have actually a couple of chapters on words like this and two appendices, because I just, you know, all of us get tripped up by these words, and I wanted to have kind of a handy glossary so people could just know what is the difference between those, so they could just look it up and figure it out.
And then this gets to a central point of the book, because earlier in the book you talk about the grammar police and how we shouldn't always listen to them. But here you are later in the book saying, well, no, we need to listen on this particular corner. And this is the whole thing about our language and about this book, is that sometimes you got to follow the rules, sometimes you got to break them.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you made that point, because that really is, you know, language is a little bit of language that's a mystery that is mysterious and magical. And I love that aspect of language. So I'm not so much interested in laying out clear black and white rules, but rather giving people a richer, deeper sense of language and exploring some of the shades of gray, because it's really hard. I mean, you can almost say any rule that you want, and I can find you a writer who's broken that rule. So I think, you know, more trying to understand at a deeper level how things work and how they don't work, that's my goal.
That's right. Even ain't has its use, correct uses, from H.L. Mencken to Sojourner Truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful book filled with wonderful examples, which I think is it really makes the book. Is you've got people, I mentioned Garrison Keillor. There's a wonderful essay by Gay Talese, portion of an essay. Jonathan Rabin, Laura Hildenbrand, just wonderful writers after another.
There's also Viagra commercials. You know, I also use pop culture, song lyrics, and Viagra commercials. Because I think good writing, you know, good writing is good writing no matter where, whether you find it in literature or on a billboard.
I think you also use Apple's Think Different, too, as well.
I do.
Well, it is a wonderful book. Bex Hex Smash Smooch. Constance Hale, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Constance Hale speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book, Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, Let Verbs Power Your Writing, is published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime to listen on demand at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa on the page. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.